You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1992 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the second class in a series given by Brother David Levin on the subject, Legalism and Faith.
Yesterday we introduced a class on this subject by bringing into crisp focus the fundamental issue with which we're dealing, which is to look at faith by studying its opposite, which in the Bible is nominated as legalism because of the vast importance that the Pharisees played in elucidating the life and teaching of Jesus, who stands over against him as the opposite, that they were the darkness and the light of God which was brought into the world. We found out that it wasn't atheism or paganism or materialism or morality per se so much, which God detested so much, but it was people who claimed to be religious, but in fact were not. And if there's no other lesson that we would learn from that, from this week, it would be that lesson. That the thing which is most odious to God, which is most unfaithful, and which is most illustrative of what God does not want, it is to claim piety and actually be totally faithless, but to live behind a cloak and a system of laws and rules, which Paul said in Colossians had the appearance of rigor, the appearance of holiness, the appearance of righteousness, but absolutely are valueless whatsoever in dealing with the essential problem, which is the indulgence of the flesh. And we saw that by whatever term that we would call this, laws, rules, codes, etc., and all the different ways that people have invented, and we'll look at this more today, of enacting this way of life, that no matter how you label it, that it was more than just a Pharisaic problem, that it went all the way back to the beginning, because the very first instance we have of addition to the law and the proliferation of law and the vain attempt to keep one from sin occurred actually in Genesis chapter 3, as we saw there, of the significant addition that Adam and Eve had to what God actually said. And more than that, giving it the imprimatur of holiness by describing God said when in fact he had not, and thus raised the tradition of men to equality with the commandments of God. And thus it went throughout history up until the foremost exponents of this way of life, the Pharisees, who developed during the exile in the matter of the few hundred years before Christ, and in the synagogue existence of the Jews who remained in exile in Babylon, is where the familiar teaching, the extrapolations, and the rabbinic teachings about Torah came into fruition, which was in the synagogues of Babylon. And that's where it primarily started. So by the time the Pharisees did appear on the scene with Jesus, they already had now well-developed thousands, who knows, of more commandments, of more ritual, of more elucidations, elaborations, definitions, and restrictions about life, so that at any given instance they could say that this was okay, that this was not, and every behavior and every act of life was regulated by the ruling of the rabbis. And yesterday we talked about some of those things which grew out of simple commands of the law, such as thou shalt not boil a kid in his mother's milk, and how from this developed hundreds and hundreds more of the kosher dietary laws from that command, each one designed to protect the possibility of accidental contamination, which would render one defiled, and in so doing would reinforce the basic mindset behind all laws and rules, which is the fear of doing something wrong, because evil would appear outside of the human being. There is something out there which can go into you and defile you, and that's the fundamental principle of the law. of making laws. The evil lies outside, and we can be protected from evil by restricting our behavior as to what can possibly avoid that. And if you ever wondered why the subject of the devil does not occur in the Old Testament, why it's only a New Testament subject, you might consider the law of Moses itself as a whole, and why, as long as that was there, there's no need to have the teaching of the New Testament on the devil and how the two really complement each other in that regard of elucidating under the Old Covenant where people perceived the locus of sin was versus the New Covenant where Jesus told us the locus of sin really was. And that's where we pick up today and discuss the activities of the Lord Himself in dealing with the Pharisees in their teaching. And the books of the Gospels have a considerable amount on this. And I want to pick one area which seems to be the one which Jesus chose as his own personal arena or battlefield, where he would take to task the Pharisees' teaching. And he used one particular segment of law to demonstrate the corruptness of the whole system. And that was the laws concerning the Sabbath. Now, to be sure, Jesus addressed the Pharisees on other issues also. We were looking at Matthew 15, where he talks to them about their ceremonial washing. We'll take a long look at that passage and its parallel passage in Mark chapter 7. He certainly discussed in the woes to them, Matthew 23, about their tithing, the mint and the dill and the cumin, and neglecting the weightier matters of the law. So Jesus certainly addressed other matters of law in his discussions with the Pharisees. The one where it appears to be that he would put foremost the way of faith versus the way of law would be in their perception of what constituted Sabbath law. Now, if you would turn for a moment to the Ten Commandments, where we have the original proposition, we can look at it, for instance, in Deuteronomy chapter 5. This is what God said about the Sabbath. Deuteronomy 5:12, observe the Sabbath day, keep it holy, as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath, the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your manservant or your maidservant or your ox or your ass or any of your cattle or the sojourner who's within your gates, that your manservant and your maidservant may rest as well as you. You shall remember that you were servants in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out hence with a mighty hand and outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. And this particular commandment already has more elaboration than any of the others. But that was not nearly satisfactory to the rabbis, who would need much more definition on this matter as to what exactly is work and what exactly or who exactly is included in these injunctions. It was not content to leave this up to personal interpretation. And at this point, we're not even beginning to talk about any spiritual applications of the Sabbath. Let's talk about within the legal system itself. How would this be applied? So the rulings had to be made. What was work and what was not work? One way they approached it was that work was divided, I believe, as 37 or 39 different categories, according to the Hebrew verb used in the description of the building of the tabernacle and the operating of the rituals of the tabernacle. But there are 30-some different actions of cutting or sewing or moving or carrying or lighting or whatever. And those would be classified as things called work. Well, now you have a bunch of categories, and then you have to go farther than that and say, well, when is it okay, and when is it not okay to do this or to do that? So it was against that sort of mind that Jesus would have to deal. Now, what I want to do first is to bring you up to date about just how this mind worked in its fullness. Sabbath laws, then we're going to go back and do these. But I want to make sure that we were real clear on what the mind was that took this word and this idea of the Sabbath and where they were going with it, because even though the content of what I'm going to read to you now is modern, the principles occurred back then. Today, our life is so complicated that the rabbis have spent a lot of time in figuring out exactly what is working, what isn't working on the Sabbath, because we have so many labor-saving devices, it's become a real challenge. At least one rabbi wrote that he was very grateful for all the modern inventions because it gave them so many more things to make rulings about. As to what they're operating, this, returning this, this time, we have all these electrical things really gave them a lot of spiritual stimulus to employees to think about all these things. So, I'm just going to read you some excerpts of some rabbinical decisions and rulings to tell from the flavor of these and how important that is. Rabbinic law forbids an individual to read by the light of a lamp on Sabbath, since he might come to adjust it. Now, this is talking about the old oil lamp. Some authorities would apply this to an electric lamp also. This, however, is disputed. The Sabbath clock. This is a timing device. Was this really useful or legal or not? Be something that turned on something on the Sabbath, as you said before. This device is quite universally accepted, and it might surprise the reader to hear that no less a person than a former chief rabbi of Palestine could not see his way to permitting its use to switch on the light on Sabbath. In deference to the great authorities who did permit it, he did not explicitly forbid its use. Reviews of this question have been written. The question of placing food on a cold, in a cold electric oven, which is subsequently turned on by a Sabbath clock, has given rise to much debate. An extensive review of this has been published. The conclusion seems to be that the food must be placed on the oven before Sabbath and the heating element and controls covered. This presumably could prevent any accidental turning on or off. The question of resetting the clock on Sabbath has been analyzed. It might be possible to permit delaying extinction if it were not for the danger of accidentally throwing the switch. However, if delaying involves resetting the clock, this is equivalent to setting initially and is forbidden on the Sabbath. The question of using an elevator on the Sabbath is complicated by the fact that its operation is usually accompanied by the switching on and off of an indicator lamp. Now remember that when the light goes on, that's considered doing work because it's called kindling. It falls under the category of kindling, the light and fire. On the other hand, a fully automatic elevator, which stops normally there before anyway, has been permitted if certain precautions are taken. The use of the electric train as a subway or such on Sabbath is generally considered forbidden, even though it is running for non-Jews. One authority bases this prohibition on its workday nature and on the possibility that a Jew's presence might make it necessary for the operator to increase his power. The opening of a refrigerator on Sabbath has become a matter of major practical importance in many Jewish communities. The question has to do, of course, when you open the refrigerator, warm air comes in, and that could cause the compressor motor to turn on before it normally would otherwise. The opening door admits warmer air and therefore raises the temperature inside more rapidly. Consequently, it causes the motor to be switched on earlier than it would have had the door remained closed. Questions of unintentional and indirect action are involved here. The fundamental question hinges on, of course, the problems of sparking or causing some electrical activity, which would fall into the category of kindling. It has been suggested that all these problems could be avoided if the thermostat were replaced by an automatic timing device. Some authorities permit opening of the refrigerator while the motor is running, so that there is no additional or earlier starting of the motor, while others permit opening the refrigerator at any time. An extensive review of the literature up to the year 1958 has been published, and more has been written since. And so on it goes. Well, the public address system, I should use it because I'm using one right now. The advisability of using a public address system in the synagogue for services is even more made more questionable by the fact that the sound produced by it is not the original sound at all, but merely a copy of it. The voice is not that of the speaker, but that of the mechanical loudspeaker, so that the listener may not be hearing the reading and prayers themselves at all. So you're not even listening to this class. One more here about hearing aids. I know many of us use those here, and you may want to know about using a hearing aid on the Sabbath. On these bases, some rabbinical prohibitions may be overruled. Consequently, some authorities permit the use of hearing aids on the Sabbath, others on holidays, and some neither. But in any case, only if the device has been switched on before the Sabbath. And the controls have been made inaccessible to avoid accidental adjustments. In addition, now here's something else that a rabbi thinks about. It's one thing to turn on a hearing aid itself, but in addition, the question of carrying the device is an entirely separate one, which must be resolved before the wearer may leave his house. In other words, that's carrying a load. That's a burden, bearing the burden on the Sabbath. It's prohibited. How do you get around that? It has been suggested that the battery be sewn to the clothing of the wearer, so it becomes part of the clothing. And then you're not bearing a burden. Okay. Now that should give you a flavor of how the legalistic mind works at its finest. Lawyers are lawyers. Regulation by this regulation. And that was religion. Now whether you talk about in today's culture with making decisions about electrical things or back in the Sabbath where it was how far, you know, what's the burden, how much is the Sabbath day burden or not. Maybe you remember, and I hope I'll get the story right, a few months ago in Jerusalem last spring there was a heavy snowfall in the late spring or the March or April or so, and it happened on the Sabbath. Now evidently in the Orthodox Court of Jerusalem they string all the houses together with some kind of ribbon or band, the purpose being that makes it all one house, so that people can go outside and walk longer distances if they never actually leave their house. So when the snow came and either collapsed or seared its barrier, the rabbis warned all people to stay in their house. Because they walked outside without this connecting thing there, they could be found to be walking too far on the Sabbath, and that's violent. So yeah. Now that's what Jesus was up against when he did the following thing. So let's look at it. Number one, what did Jesus do on the Sabbath? Now you go down the eight things that we know Jesus did on the Sabbath. First one's found in Mark chapter 1, and we'll be in verse 21 to 28. They went into the Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and taught. And they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one by authority and not as the scribes. And immediately there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit. And he cried out, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be silent and come out of him." And the unclean spirit, convulsing him and crying with a loud voice, came out of him. They were amazed, so that they questioned among themselves, saying, "What is this? A new teaching? With authority he commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him." And at once the fame spread everywhere throughout the region, throughout all the surrounding regions of Galilee. And the next follows right after that, which is the healing of Jesus' mother-in-law. Presumably late in that same day. And immediately he left the synagogue and entered the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. Now Simon's mother-in-law lay sick with a fever, and immediately they told him of her. And he came and took her by the hand and lifted her up, and she fever left her, and she served them. Probably late in the afternoon, the very next thing we read is this evening time, verse 32. Okay. Two more episodes occurred to us. Men also close together, we'll put those up, 3 and 4 together, and we can look at those and end of Mark chapter 2 and the beginning of Mark 3. Now, many of these are also in other Gospels, and I'll be referring to some of them also. But in Mark 2, in verse 23, we have the incident where Jesus and disciples, they ate the grain. One Sabbath, he was going through the grain fields, and as they made their way, his disciples began to pluck ears of grain. And the Pharisees said to him, "Look, why are they doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath?" And he said to them, "Have you never read what David did when he was in need and was hungry, he and those who were with him? And how he entered the house of God when Abiathar was high priest and ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for any but the priest to eat, and also gave it to those who were with him. And he said to them, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath." In the first instance, it was merely a miracle and the people were amazed. The second one of healing Peter's mother-in-law done in private. And again, there was no contention. But now for the first time, we have contention following a work that Jesus did. And for the first time, they raised the issue, this is not lawful. But whose laws were they referring to? The law of God? Or all the other Pharisaic traditions that they added? Certainly those. Because if you go back to Deuteronomy or Exodus, you won't find anything about a prohibition to eat on the Sabbath. But to take a day of rest. You know, work that would, the intention clearly being a day of rest, not a day of starvation. But they were so afraid that they might do something wrong that they said, no, you can't even feed yourself or prepare, actually prohibition here isn't preparing food. This was added also. You can't do that on the Sabbath. And Jesus point to the higher authority yet of the bread of the presence in dealing with this instance here. But to make note, just the progression of what we're going through here and how the contention against the Lord increases. So here's the first one where what he does is publicly noticed and they raise the issue of it is not lawful. Now look how the Lord handles the next one. We're going to look at this in Mark and also flip back to Matthew because the warning we have here is incomplete and either one to a significant degree. Another Sabbath. We don't know how much later, but we're in Mark chapter 3 verse 1. Again, he entered the synagogue, and this is probably in Capernaum also. Here it is in Capernaum, not probably. And the man was there who had a withered hand, and they watched him to see whether he would heal him on the Sabbath. And now we find that healing is included in their restrictions and prohibitions, the things that ought not to be done on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man who had the withered hand, "Come here." And he said to them, "Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or do harm, to save life or to kill?" And that sounds like an appropriate question. Now, we'll turn back to Matthew, because we'll find out that that question is really an answer, because they asked him the question first. And look at Matthew chapter 12, and we'll see that this, what Jesus said, takes on even much more power when we see it in the context of a full discourse. But in Matthew 12 and in verse 9 is where the same episode is recorded here. And note how the conversation went when we piece these two together. I'm going to put in Luke's account to get a fuller picture. "Behold, there is a man with a withered hand," now in Matthew 12, 9. "And they asked him, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" That's what they asked first. They said, because they came there, as it said, strictly to test him. They knew the man was there, and they came there, and they contested it. And they said, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? And what did Jesus answer? That's when he said, is it lawful to do good or to do harm? And he reframed their question. It's not a matter of working or healing, it's a matter of doing good. And he put it right back on them. And he made the stakes even higher when he said, to save life or to kill. I don't think he was talking about the physical at that point, but the interpretation, the moral, and the emotional, and the mental, saving life or killing. as he told them later, that when they made proselytes, they made them twice as much children of hell as themselves. And I think that's what he meant by living and killing, with their interpretation of the Sabbath laws, in addition to doing good and doing evil in the physical sense. So what they thought of was an issue of legalities. Jesus said, no, this is an issue of morality and of doing good. It's an issue of service to God and your fellow man, not hiding behind your fences and your rules and pretending the world didn't exist for one day out of seven. And it's no wonder then that we read the next two phrases back in Mark, but they were silent. And he looked around at them with anger. I believe one of the only two times we read the Lord is angry, the other being when he clears the money changers out. Grieved at their hardness of heart, and said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. And then the tagline that is recorded, the Pharisees went out and immediately, that is on the Sabbath day, held counsel with the Herodians against him how to destroy him. They who were so holy in keeping the law held counsel to kill the Son of God on the Sabbath day. And presumably that was not against any of their laws. Some time later now, we're in Jerusalem, and now we move to John chapter 5. And as the ministry of Jesus progresses and the confrontations with the Pharisees increase on this particular issue, on which the law of Moses as a whole would stand or fall, that is on the interpretation of Sabbath law, that Jesus used this as an illustration of the principle that by the keeping of laws shall no man be justified. So here we are in Jerusalem. And we have a man with an illness of 38 years duration that he could not walk. And we have a lengthy account of what happened, which we'll summarize here. Verse 2, John 5, a pool in Jerusalem. Porches, as it says, or porticos, five areas that go down to the pool, in the pool. In these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, paralyzed. One was there, 38 years. Jesus saw him and knew that he had been lying there a long time. He said, do you want to be healed? And the man answered, sir, no man has ever put me into the pool when the water is troubled. Jesus said, rise, take up your pallet, and be healed. And at once the man was healed and took up his pallet and walked. Now that day was the Sabbath, that John tersely records. Now that day was the Sabbath. 38 years. He lay there, and Jesus said, today, you will get up and walk. Injunctions about what is a burden, and how much should someone carry, what constitutes a Sabbath day's load. It's not your clothes, it's your power. You shouldn't be carrying this. You're doing work. And that's all they could see. For the power and the grace of God, and the authority of the Lord Jesus Christ, and the healing of the man, you're carrying a pallet on the Sabbath. What's the matter with you? Who told you to do that? That's amazing there, is it not? He answered them, the man who healed me said to me, take up your pallet to walk. They asked him, who is the man who told you that? And he said, I don't know. Jesus had left. Verse 14, afterward Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, see, you are well, sin no more. And nothing worse befall you. The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who healed him. And this is why Jews persecuted Jesus. The Jews persecuted Jesus because he did this on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, my Father is working still, and I am working. This is why the Jews sought all the more to kill him. Because he not only broke the Sabbath, in their view, that is, but also called God his Father, making himself equal with God, likewise, in their view, because he neither broke the Sabbath nor made himself equal to God. Three more. Back to Luke, chapter 13. Woman of 18 years infirmity. Verse 10 of Luke 13. Now he was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath. And there was a woman who had a spirit of infirmity for 18 years. Probably what today we would call probably arthritis, either rheumatoid or osteoarthritis. She was bent over and could not fully straighten herself. And when Jesus saw her, he called her and said to her, "Woman, you are freed from her infirmity." He laid his hands upon her. She was made straight. She praised God. But the ruler of the synagogue, indignant, because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, said to the people, "There are 6 days in which work ought to be done. Come on those days and be healed, not on the Sabbath day." And again, all that they could see was healing had taken place. The work had been done on the Sabbath, and not that a woman was loose of infirmity. And now Jesus rebukes them for their hypocrisy by saying, "If you had an animal that fell in a pit on the Sabbath, would you not?" That's the next sentence. Here he talks about untying his ox or his ass to give it water. They would do that on the Sabbath. They had provisions for their things that had to be done for the care of their animals themselves. Why can't I loose this woman also? Luke 14, the first few verses now, the man with dropsy, a similar situation. Another Sabbath, he's dining at the house of a Pharisee. They were watching him. A man with dropsy, a disease which could apply to several conditions today, something of a water-retentive nature. Jesus spoke to the lawyers and Pharisees saying, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" Again, the question is raised. They were silent. Then he took him and healed him and let him go. And here he cites the precedent of, if you had an animal that fell into a pit, you would certainly take it out on the Sabbath. But they would make no reply to what he had done. So once more, another confrontation. And another example was left in silence. And lastly, the eighth example, John chapter 9. And presumably these last four are all in Jerusalem. The man born blind. The whole chapter is devoted to this. You know the account well. Just to point out that Jesus took a clay, put it in his eyes, and healed him. And in verse 14 is the key verse. Now there was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. Not only did he heal, but he engaged in making clay to do so. And again, the Pharisees were indignant. And said in verse 16, some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." So those are the things that Jesus did. Now let's look at these as a whole and analyze them. From the first to the last, there's an increase in the public notice, the contention of the Pharisees that went on. This last one is the account unfolds, the man is excommunicated, and the Pharisees fought all the more to kill him. So we have an increase in the contention that's coming up each time Jesus does this. We also notice that he has a preference. In fact, except for one possible, it's a question for number 7, what's the nature of the exact disease is unknown, that all of these were chronic conditions, and indeed he's kept on getting say more and more things, so to speak, to highlight this, to the end where it's now someone's born blind. And the point being that in any one of these, he could have waited a few hours till sundown and done the healing. Possible exception number 2, where Luke records that she had a high fever and she was acutely ill. But the rest of these are clearly chronic conditions. And very obviously so. A man born blind. A woman with 18 years of infirmity. 38 years he couldn't walk. The man with the crippled hand. They were chronic conditions. Something that could have waited. But he chose the Sabbath day to do this. So now we know specifically that Jesus is going out of his way to create problems. We would say, yes, he's rocking the boat. He's rocking it in a very big way. He is taking the attack onto their grounds and showing that their laws the date created by the Sabbath were not at all in the best interest of people, but were restricted rather than producing service, producing good works. And it came to pass that, as you gleaned from the reading I gave you earlier, that the Pharisees' idea of holiness was to do less and less and less and less. And Jesus kept on saying, no, it's in healing and in doing good. It's the fullness of the teaching of the Sabbath is as God intended it, to give people rest from their sins, rest from their ills, rest from their pains, their toil and trouble, so we can model that behavior that God gives us in fullest in the kingdom by helping people out. Because that's what the Sabbath is all about. It's doing good and doing more and more and more. And it's a model of God's service towards His creation. As He said, my Father works still. God worked for 6 days to create, and on the seventh day and every day since then, He's been working to sustain. He's been working to forgive and to restore and to rebuild everything that we've torn down in His creation. God is working still. Sabbath after Sabbath after Sabbath, day after day, God works, God works. And when Jesus came and said, I am Lord of the Sabbath, He meant that I represent the teaching of God and God on the Sabbath in doing the work of sustaining and healing that has to be done to the fallen creation. And He chose the Sabbath day. Indeed, He had to do that on the Sabbath. He had to choose the Sabbath day to fulfill the works of God in bringing a broken creation to fullness. And all they could see was making clay. That's against the law. Carrying a pallet. Oh, how much does that pallet weigh? How far are you going with it? That's against the law. And you can see how different these approaches were of faith and legalism. And you can see why Jesus chose this way to demonstrate repeatedly the work He had to do of His Father to do good works of faith on the Sabbath. On any one of those occasions, how easy it could have been for Him to say, I like to do good works, but I don't like to be crucified. If I just do this tomorrow, there'll be no problem. We don't have to rock the boat. We can just do what we need to do and not offend other people. And how could He have ever talked to people without faith had He done that? And that was a temptation for Him, to have all that great power, to know what would happen to Him, because eventually the Pharisees were successful in their plottings to kill Him, as we read. And He knew that. And He went right into their home territory and challenged them on their laws and paid the price of being crucified by them for that, to be raised by the Father. So it was the Lord Himself who gave us the clearest teaching about faith, because He lived faith. And He did faith. And He just didn't teach faith and talk faith, but He was, as a brother Norman exhorted to us this morning from James, a doer of the word, and did what had to be done. Following the New Testament times, or the times of Jesus, the issue unfortunately was not settled. And even though in Colossians 2, where it says that He, in the crucifixion of Jesus, was also the crucifixion of the legal system of Moses, in Colossians 2, He nailed that to the cross. The Jewish influence remained throughout the time of the New Testament. And thus we find, as we go through Acts and letters, that this becomes the single key issue, the most important issue of all the problems that Paul dealt with in the new ecclesias was the legalism, both from the external sources of the overt contentions of the Pharisees, and also the natural things that people brought with them. They came to the new church, the new wineskins that had said, what should have been new wineskins, but still carrying the old skins, and trying to put the new wine or the new covenant in old wineskins. So if you look through, just as an overview, in the letters of the New Testament, what are the great themes? Romans, entirely given over virtually to this one question. Galatians, same thing. Ephesians, significantly. Philippians, largely. Major portions of the New Testament, the book of Titus. Again, the main thing, one of the main things is dealing with the legalism of the New Testament. So over and over and over, we see the necessity of following up on that teacher, on that teaching teacher. So we come to ask ourselves, therefore, the same question that the New Testament writers ask, and repeatedly have to remind us in their theological writings, this question. Can a person attain salvation by following rules? Is that the way of holiness or not? We thought it would have been settled by Jesus, but we find that they still dealt with it. So we look at a number of passages where specifically this answer, same answer is given. We'll look first in Acts chapter 13. This is Paul speaking in the synagogue in Antioch. And we'll see how in these eight passages, how this question is rotated slightly and given full view for our consideration. Acts 13:38. Let it be known to you, therefore, brethren, that through this man forgiveness of sins is proclaimed to you, and through him, or by him, probably through him, everyone that believes is freed from everything from which you could not be free by the law of Moses. That was the teaching of Paul. That through Jesus you could be free, loose. Remember the parables of Jesus, the example he taught about loosing that woman from Satan down for 18 years. The law of Moses could not do that. Paul writing in Galatians chapter 2, early Paul. And here's his words of rebuke to Peter, who was carried away by the excesses of the Judaizers when he refused to eat with the Gentiles. And Paul said this, I'm picking up the thought in verse 15, we ourselves who are Jews by birth and not Gentile sinners, yet who know that a man is not justified by works of the law, but through faith in Christ Jesus. In order to be justified by faith in Christ and not by works of the law, because by works of the law shall no flesh be justified. And again in the next chapter, verse 11, now it is evident that no man is justified in God's sight by the law, for he who through faith is righteous shall live. And here he cites the superiority of the new covenant. If it's through faith, then it's not by law. Ephesians chapter 2, verses 8 and 9. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not your own doing, it is the gift of God. Not only because of works, lest any man should boast. It's by grace through faith, and not because of works. And we'll pick up the paradox in verse 10 in a couple of days of that same passage. Romans chapter 3, verse 20. The later writing of Paul, then the Galatians. And he says this, very succinctly, for no human being will be justified in his sight, that is God's sight, by works of the law, since through the law comes knowledge of sin. 2 Timothy chapter 1. You have to ask yourself, why did Paul have to say this so often? Why do we have to repeat this so much? Is there a basic fundamental problem that doesn't seem to go away here? 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 8 and 9. Do not be ashamed then of testifying to our Lord, nor of me as prisoner, but take your share of suffering for the gospel and the power of God, who saved us and called us with a holy calling, not in virtue of our own works, but in virtue of his own purpose and the grace which he gave us in Christ ages ago. We can take the last two now. Titus chapter 3, verse 5. Again, one of Paul's long sentences, but verse 5 says, he saved us not because of deeds done by us in righteousness, but in virtue of his own mercy, And lastly, the passage in Philippians where Paul talks about all his accomplishments under the law and said they were worthless. He counted them as junk and as refuse. And that knowing Christ Jesus was as much surpassing value. So we'll pick up there tomorrow. We consider the significance of the answer that Paul consistently gives us to this question.